People who find a regulation inconvenient never say it, that's why they're against it, or very rarely. What they say is that it's socially bad, that it's socially inappropriate, that it's socially restrictive and depression-making. And we had an outbreak of that in recent times, and it did two things. It removed regulations that might have been appropriate in the case of something like Enron, and it justified the keeping and the position of those who were doing
young
well,
the Roosevelt administration.
Those who were in it.
Most everybody in that administration
had
a sense of fealty, a sense of loyalty, which was beyond anything since, and maybe too great. In those days, along with everybody else, had ideas until Roosevelt had spoken, and then I automatically accepted his. And through the whole structure of the New Deal Washington, including the war years, the greatest mark of pride was to be a Roosevelt man. But this was in turn related to the fact that the president had great flexibility of accommodation to the disaster and despair of the Depression years. This was a terrible time, a perilous time in the history of the Republic. And the singular feature of Franklin D. Roosevelt was his pragmatic accommodation to whatever needed to be done. If you ever hear some politicians say, I'm going to adhere strictly to principle, then you should take shelter because you know you're going to suffer. And in contrast, Roosevelt was in his time the supreme pragmatist. And one other thing, too, which is of present relevance. He used radio with the same skill that Ronald Reagan uses television. He was a master of that medium of communication, the first. I would be reluctant to single out the New Deal as a particularly strong example of academic participation. There was a great deal of academic participation, but there was a great deal of participation of lawyers. George Wall came in from the law. Adlai Stevenson came in from the law. Harry Hopkins came in from the Roosevelt, from the New York State apparatus, and so forth. What was unique, what was original in that period, was an addressing of the economic problem. A strong attack on the economic problem, the NRA, the AAA, the various work agencies, and so forth. And these naturally attracted economists to Washington. And this was particularly true of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, which was run by economists. But that was the consequence of an administration that was first addressing in a major way an economic problem. Now, as in the late 20s, the impression, this is a very subtle but a very important point, the impression that somehow or other, if everything is left to the market to laissez-faire, if the government keeps its hands off, there is a God-given tendency for things to work out. Laissez-faire, laissez-passer, this is a ruling fact and is above and beyond government. A theological commitment to doing nothing on the assumption that the economy cannot fail. A neoclassical idea that has classical roots going back to Adam Smith and David Ricardo. That is one thing. And out of this, I would worry most about the way in which debt is being created. Not so much the public debt, that probably is manageable, but the way in which we are creating a debt to other countries, which withdrawn could have a devastating effect sometime on the dollar, the way in which we're massing the debts of private corporations in this takeover movement, which could have a very depressant effect if we had some downturn in economic activity. Same thing that is now true in agriculture. And the effect of the debt structure, which we already see as regards the Latin American loans. All of this could one day lead to, a loss of confidence in the dollar, a rush to withdraw funds from the United States. And that is the picture which would worry me most about the policies of the present administration. A Democrat all my life, but I think I can, and I think I can honestly say that the collegial efforts of the Democratic Party at wisdom to create great and wise courses of action is not appreciably higher than that of the Republicans. I suppose that I would, in economics, most likely like to be remembered, and most plausibly I will be remembered, for bringing emphasis to an economic structure in which the characteristic organization is the great corporation rather than the competitive enterprise, and of seeing economic life as a bipolar phenomenon, by which I mean seeing it as a structure on the one hand of a few hundred great corporations, and seeing it on the other hand as the residual structure of agriculture, small business, the services, and arguing that controlling economic behavior in the two parts is by no means the same, has to be examined separately. I would hope that there might be some minor effect, which I was at the time very proud. I maybe shouldn't go back and read it again. Arguing ironically, that socialism in the United States was the result of organized sports. It takes people at a vulnerable age and makes teamwork more than individual work the thing. It subjects people to the authority of the team captain or the coach. And as I say, this is at an age where people are vulnerable, and therefore this is team sports are the breeding ground for socialism and must be watched very carefully. And I had an organization in the piece that's ran in Harper's called the CIA, the Congress for Individualist Athletics. It was written under a pseudonym because I was then an ambassador. I couldn't write under my own name. One day the postman struggled into my room at Harvard with a pile of letters this thick that had been sent on from Harper's of people who, well, they fell into three classes. People who wanted to know whether it was real or not. People who wanted to join. And people who demanded that I exclude baseball from the list because baseball is not, as they said, a socialist sport. When you are up at the bat, you're on your own. Well, it's an example of the dangers of using irony. Many people are going to, under the best of circumstances, take it seriously.